Sustain 267.
Welcome to Sustain 267, where we host conversations on different issues affecting climate change in Botswana and the rest of Africa. I am your host, Patokile Seitse. The 11th to the 13th of June 2021 brought us the 47th G7 Summit held in Cornwall, United Kingdom, under the slogan Build Back Better. The Group of Seven, or G7, is an intergovernmental political forum made up of seven nations, namely Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States of America. The leaders of these countries represent over 60% of the people living in democracies across the world, representing over 2.2 billion people and over half of the world's economy. To be exact, 60% of global net wealth. The European Union also sent presidents from the European Commission and the European Council. Additionally, there was an African president, President Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa. The talking points for the 2021 G7 meeting was the COVID-19 pandemic and vaccines, as well as promoting free trade and fighting climate change ahead of COP26, which will also be held in the UK later this year. In today's conversation, I'm joined by Tasneem Esop. We'll be unpacking for the African continent and its people and the impact of the summit's resolutions. Tasneem Esop is currently the executive director of Climate Action Network International. She has just completed serving her second term as the commissioner in the National Planning Commission in South Africa and leads the work of climate change and the just transition. She previously headed the climate change team in WWF International and served as the head of delegation for the organization at the UNFCCC. She became a member of the provincial parliament in Western Cape in 1994 and held the positions of provincial minister of trade, public works and property management and provincial Minister for the Environment, Planning and Economic Development when she resigned from politics. Tasneem was an anti-apartheid activist from an early age in different capacities until the democratic elections in 1994. During this time, she was a student and youth activist, a teacher and a trade unionist. The first question I asked was, it's been all over our news. It's seven leaders of rich countries meeting to talk about their economies. Why should it matter to us as Africans?
Well, it is interesting that when the seven wealthiest countries in the world meet, we all actually want to hear what they have to say, not so much about what they're going to do for themselves, but they also discuss what they plan to do in other countries or in other continents. And, you know, a previous G7, so for example, the G7 held in 2019 in France, they emerged out of that G7 with something called the Biarritz Declaration on Africa. And so the G7 doesn't only focus on their own economies, they also look at what they plan to do with other economies. And that's why the G7 is an important space to watch. And also, of course, as we've seen in this G7, often very disappointing, you know, typically coming out with big announcements about all kinds of commitments. I'll talk more, of course, about what happened in this G7. And when you look at it, the track record of delivery isn't a good one. And especially when it comes to these commitments that they make for other countries. And so, yeah, it is, you know, interesting. It does take a lot of attention because people do want to hear what they have to say, you know, as the richest, wealthiest countries in the world.
Yeah. I think before we go into the commitments that they made, we know that there's a danger in our futures being discussed without us in the room. There's a phrase that is now used quite popularly, nothing for us without us. And there's not a single African country that is within that G7. Yes, the South African president, President Cyril Ramaphosa, was there, but he wasn't there in the same capacity. Should we be worried about the decisions that are being made without us? What will the impact of that be?
Exactly. Now, that's exactly the point. That's why I'm saying the G7 is important to watch because they don't only make decisions about their own economies. They make decisions and plans for everybody else. Without everybody else having a seat at the table, having the voice represented, or even considering what, you know, the needs of everyone else are. And so that is exactly the problem. And this is this is the problem with the system in the world, where those who are well-resourced, have power, they are the ones making decisions for the rest of the world. This is the fundamental problem. And so we do need to look at what comes out of these G7s. We have to continuously shine a spotlight on the fact that these, seven leaders of seven wealthy countries, mostly men, are making decisions on behalf of the world. And until such time, our leaders, especially in developing countries, step up and say, well, you know, we want to be at a table where decisions are being made about our futures, our future economies, the way we deal with our challenges. All of that is being discussed in the G7. And that is why the multilateral processes, so the UN, even though there are so many challenges, of course, with UN processes, at least in a multilateral process, all countries have a seat at the table and all countries have a voice. And so that doesn't, of course, mean that there aren't power blocks in the UN, but the opportunity for everyone to be represented. That is why a multilateral process is important, and these kind of separate spaces like the G7 and the G20, they're meant to, in fact, really look at implementing, big global actions that come out of, these multilateral processes as well. But they've taken a life of its own. And it has become, sometimes seen as substituting the multilateral processes.
So far, we've been worried about not being in the room. But have there been previous decisions that have had any real impact that we can feel the impact of now because of decisions made at the G7? Maybe we really just want a seat at the table of, at the table of a conversation that really doesn't matter. Have these conversations up to now, and what are maybe some of the experiences over the past years that can be attributed to decisions made by the G7 in Africa?
Well, if I think about it, let's go back to the G7 in 2019 in France. That is the most recent one before this one, because the one in 2020 was cancelled. It was going to be hosted by Trump, as you might remember. In that one, as I said, there was a declaration on Africa. There were huge commitments made to address inequality, to address the health systems in Africa, to ensure that there's, accessible health for people in Africa, infrastructure programs, digital economy. And you tell me, as an African, whether you have seen that materialize. So remember that these kinds of commitments were made in 2019, that talks to health infrastructure, access to health, improving healthcare in Africa. And then we got hit with the pandemic. And you tell me that the health systems were adequate and prepared, etc., for that kind of crisis. No, it wasn't. And when we now, and so these two talk to each other, the G7 in France and this one now. Now, when we hit with a global pandemic and we need support from the G7, they were extremely disappointing in what they were willing to commit. And so, yes, a lot of big rhetoric, but does it really materialize in terms of action on the ground? I don't think at the levels at which, these big commitments have been made and announced, it sounds good, but it hasn't changed the overall reality in Africa particularly, because they focus quite a lot on, we're going to do this for Africa, we're going to have a huge infrastructure build for Africa, et cetera, et cetera. And when you look at it, if there's any infrastructure, it's usually you know, those companies from G7 countries will come and invest here. And again, money flows out of Africa. So I don't, to be quite honest, Beto, I'm very cynical or skeptical about, you know, these G7 commitments really making a difference to the lives of people in Africa and the lives of people who matter in Africa. You know, we have to address issues of poverty, inequality. And so I believe that for our development in Africa, we need to be making those plans and those decisions as Africans and not rely on, you know, the G7 and others to do that for us. And so, yeah, you're right. It's not just about the seat at the table. It's how those decisions get made in the first place. And when we need global solidarity, when we need the commitments of resources, for example, to be forthcoming, that's not charity. That's not aid. These are commitments, for example, on climate finance, which is one real concrete example. The finance, the commitments they've made have not been fulfilled. So certainly, we don't want them to be making decisions on behalf of us. We want them to fulfill commitments that they've made to us. And the development of our continent, Africa, the countries in Africa, that development and how we develop should be coming from us.
Very true. We should be leading our own development. But now that we've gotten to the conversation of their financial commitments, we saw that the G7 has reaffirmed to jointly mobilize $100 billion per year from public and private sources until 2025. And in addition to that, they will end the funding of new coal generation in developing countries, and they'll be offering $2.8 billion to stop using coal because, as we know, it's one of the dirtiest fuels that there is. With that being said, the world's developed countries had also pledged in 2015, so this is now 6 years later, they'd pledged to raise $100 billion in this kind of climate financing for developing countries each year from 2020 onwards. And recognizing that climate change has been largely caused by the emissions of the wealthier countries. So basically, they were asked, they were like, we'll pay the bill. The problem now is that the recent numbers suggest that they are falling about $20 billion a year short of that goal. Then it becomes a thing of, yes, there are these commitments being made, these financial commitments being made, but they're failing to meet them and further going on to make further commitments. Is there a way we can hold them accountable for at least the positives that they commit to?
Well, you know, Beto, that $100 billion commitment is nearly a decade old. It got concretized in Paris, but it was actually a pledge made in Copenhagen already. So, you know, the fact that they've made that commitment nearly a decade ago, still not fulfilled, is a real sign that, you know, we cannot trust the kind of commitments that rich countries are making because they haven't delivered on those commitments. And so they've got some very heavy lifting to do in terms of building trust, you know, by actually delivering what they've committed to. And so with this G7 outcome, I think the disappointment was related to that, that they committed to committing to fulfill a commitment that was made many years ago with no concrete details about the numbers or how much would each of those countries be contributing towards that commitment's delivery. By when will this happen? None of those details have been forthcoming. It was only after the G7, in fact, that you know, some countries came forward, like Canada, and put forward their figures. I think Germany's come forward. I think also Japan. So, you know, why they did not do that at the G7, come out of the G7 with that kind of plan for the delivery of this $100 billion per annum by 2020, the by 2025 is something that has to come on top of what was supposed to be delivered by 2020. So clearly, you know, when developing countries get pushed to do more on climate, they keep on saying, well, but where's the finances that you've committed to? And again, as I said, this really contributes to an overall breakdown of trust. You know, developing countries and many African countries were the first to come out with their new NDCs in this round before rich countries came out with their NDCs. And so on both sides, the delivery of finance is a challenge and their own actions. These rich, wealthiest G7 countries, for example, should have been leading on reducing their emissions so that, you know, the climate impacts that's being felt by those who are least responsible in especially poorer developing countries, you know, they're bearing the burden. So overall, this issue that we talk about, climate justice, we want climate justice, is really about all of this, you know, that we have to hold accountable those who are responsible historically for this crisis in the first place. They are required, in terms of the convention, in fact, to be going and leading and going first and fast. They're supposed to be also providing the kind of support to developing countries so that they can also deal with, you know, especially the impacts of climate change, but also to take action to reduce emissions. But the, you know, the percentage of emissions, especially in least developing countries, is nothing compared to what, of course, the rich countries are emitting. So overall, we have to be holding them accountable. The problem is that there aren't legal processes to hold, you know, the Paris Agreement is not a legally binding. It's a voluntary system that they've set up through that agreement. We depend on everybody's goodwill and good faith. There's no compliance mechanism. There's a compliance mechanism, but it doesn't have teeth, you know, so they can't say, well, we're going to do this. You know, there's no enforcement mechanism to compel countries to do certain things. So that's the system that's been set up. So the only pressure, really, in my view, is for us as civil society, as citizens of the world, to be putting pressure on our governments and in turn to be putting pressure on those who are supposed to be taking responsibilities and delivering commitments that they have not done. So again, you know, it is going to come down to us to keep that pressure going, to hold governments accountable and just keep their feet to the fire consistently.
I think on the conversation of keeping the pressure on and possibly transferring the pressure and accountability, according to the International Institute for Sustainable Development, which is IIS, between January 2020 and March 2021, G7 attendees together spent $189 billion on fossil fuel projects and just $147 billion on clean forms of energy, which is a quite significant difference. Less than a fifth of the fossil fuel spending came with conditions that would force industries to make specific changes or adopt stronger climate targets. These are the funds that have been committed by the developed countries. But then that begs the question of, is this not then positioning the G7 for bullying? Aren't they then saying, you guys as the global South, you guys as Africa cannot continue to invest in fossil fuels, but we will continue to do that and grow our economies? Departing from the argument of what should and shouldn't be done, in terms of fairness and just economic growth, is that not positioning them to bully developing countries while protecting their economies and growing their economies?
Well, I mean, that's exactly the problem with the G7 outcomes. It is all about their own economic growth. It has been all about their own economic interests. It has been all about their own corporates in their own countries' interests as well. And nothing more demonstrates that so sharply and so unjustly than how they have conducted themselves around the issue of vaccines. to deal with this global pandemic. Not a sign of commitment to a sense of global solidarity. You know, it was all about their pharmaceuticals and their interests, and they weren't willing to agree to this TRIPS waiver that will allow for the freeing up of patents. So that's exactly it. Again, on this whole fossil fuel investments, of course, made the announcement that they're not going to be funding any coal internationally. They're not saying they're not going to fund any coal domestically. So Japan still has a lot of investments domestically in coal. You know, and this is, I want to make a separate point. It is a problem, of course, that these rich, developed, highly industrialized countries have built up their economies over the years by the use of fossil fuels, which have caused the problems in climate. We now have, of course, alternatives to that. And what we should be seeing is a scaled up investment in renewable energy. I would say that, you know, if our African countries and our political leaders could put their foot down and say to these rich countries, we do not want your investments in fossil fuels on our continent. We are rich in resources in terms of solar, wind, etc., renewable resources. What we want is scaled up investment in that and to leapfrog our economies into this new sustainable future that we're all wanting, right? But we don't. We don't do that. And so they will continue bullying us. They will continue to decide what our investments should look like that would benefit them. It's a fundamental problem. And it does talk to the leadership in Africa that, you know, right now we are absolutely comfortable that a company can come into Botswana and start drilling for oil in one of the most vulnerable places in the Okavango. We are comfortable that the East African pipeline is going to be something that is, you know, the investments in the African East African pipeline. We're comfortable that there's going to be exploration and further coal development in Mozambique. We're comfortable even in South Africa to continue with these kinds of investments inside our country. So when do we as Africa say, well, no, this is actually investing in a sector that is going to be dying out and should die out. So why would you lock this continent into the past and not look at investing into the future? That is a fundamental question. So, you know, bullying is successful as far as you are willing to accept bullying. So we need to put our foot down. We need to really say no to fossil fuel investments. Development is not reliant on fossil fuel investments. If it was, we would have addressed poverty and inequality in this continent many, many, many years ago. So that's a false notion. And I do think there are alternative models for development in Africa that will not be reliant on old, dirty sectors, that is not reliant on the kind of economic models that the West and the North has dictated to us. And we should find our own sustainable path, learning the lessons of our own histories, you know, using the indigenous knowledge, local knowledge of our communities in Africa. Why are we so set on trying to follow the models of the global North? So we really have to do a lot of introspection ourselves.
We're going to circle back to the alternative methods, because models that we can use for economic growth, because I really like to end the podcast on a positive note, on a point of there's something that we can do and we are not just sitting ducks. But in the 25-page communique by the G7 leaders, which summed up their shared agenda, it's going to speak to something that you actually just brought up. They, for the first time, they were talking about climate change, and that commitment was the leaders committed to a green revolution that would limit the rise in global temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius. They also promised to reach net zero carbon emissions by 2050, half emissions by 2030, and to conserve or protect at least 30% of land and oceans by 2030. Which, like you were just saying, they're saying one thing and doing another. Looking at the commitment, looking at the money that they are putting into Africa, the examples that you cited. We're going to put those examples in the show notes if anyone would like to read more on it. We also have an episode on Save the Okavango, which has more detail on that. We'll also link it in the show notes. If our leaders are seeing that clearly, there's nothing here that we're benefiting from this conversation. Why don't they just pull out of these? You talked about alternative investment methods. When approached by Recon Africa, a Canadian company, and Canada is part of the G7, and they want to drill for oil in the Okavango Delta, which is one of the most pristine areas that they are in the world. Why don't our leaders just say no? I know it's such a basic question, but it's a question that we ask ourselves often. Why not just say, no, we don't want your money?
I think, you know, that's exactly the kind of question I'm posing right now. Is why are we, well, I'm not going to say we, I will rather say political leaders, because I don't think we must co-own their bad decision-making and their lack of leadership. You know, I mean, honestly, I think that when we investigate this a little bit more, I'm sure that there are vested interests and connections. You know, there's not really everything in the fossil fuel industry isn't, you know, not only are they a dirty emitting sector, but they generally don't have a good reputation in terms of their business practice as well. So I'm sure there could be vested interests, and there is this false notion amongst many still, that development depends on this foreign direct investment, no matter what it is, no matter what it does to our countries. We need to address our development challenges here. We've got high levels of poverty, unemployment, etc. And that's consistently the argument that many developing countries, and especially in Africa, will adopt. We need to develop. You develop, now it's our turn, without thinking through the fact that, you know, if you look at it in the kind of long-term perspective, fossil fuels have not contributed to the development of Africa. Because if I consider what the meaning of development is, then it is exactly taking care of your people, making sure that they have access to health, making sure that there's access to education and quality education, that the people are properly housed, you know, that there's jobs or there's livelihoods, et cetera, et cetera. But who benefits from the fossil fuel industry? It has always been the elites, always the elites in our society. And that's why we have high levels of inequality. So this notion that we need fossil fuels because it's important for our development is a false one. I mean, you know, how many people have access to energy on the continent? It's a serious problem. Sub-Saharan Africa has the highest rates of lack of energy access. You know, and so I think we must be challenging our leaders. You know, they claim they are acting on behalf of people, and generally they have not, because we can see the challenges in most countries in our continent. I think it's about, but the worst problem is, and this is why we need the connecting up of citizens across the world, civil society, because when Canada makes these global commitments in a G7, we're not going to invest, we're going to start moving to a green revolution, blah, blah. And then on the other hand, they continue investing elsewhere, their companies. Then our peers, our citizens in Canada must hold their government accountable. So we must be connected, our struggles will have to be connected. They must put pressure on their government to stop doing what they are doing elsewhere, not just what they're doing domestically, because there's serious challenges there as well, but certainly what they are doing elsewhere in other countries. So this kind of global solidarity and connectedness is a really important part of this, you know, holding to account, keeping the pressure on our government. And I don't want us to miss this. But Pato, I wanted to come back to this issue about this coal commitment that came out of, you know, no investment in coal internationally.
Please do.
Just before this G7 met, the International Energy Agency, which has generally been a conservative agency, their members are OECD countries, they came out with a very important report, a 1.5 report, net zero energy pathways report. And essentially, the IEA was saying that, you know, to keep 1.5 alive, basically, to achieve net zero by 2050, countries, especially the rich countries, must stop investment in all fossil fuels now. They didn't say, oh, just stop your investment in coal. They said, stop your investment in all fossil fuels. So that includes oil and gas. And the G7 did not say oil and gas. It just said coal, because they have seen the writing on the wall. Coal is, it's already, it's almost, we can say, a done deal. Coal is not going to be a sector that grows in the future. It is on its way out. You know, investments are drying up, and there's just huge pressure. And so coal's future is pretty clear. It's in oil and gas that we now have to look at, right? And they're not making commitments on that. And why not? Because they have a lot of interests and vested interest in the oil and gas sectors. And it's offshore interests, it's in their own countries. And so they didn't even respond to this energy agency saying, to be able to keep 1.5 alive, to be able to get to net zero by 2050, you have to end now, in 2021, all investments in fossil fuels. That's not what they say. But they can say they're committed to net zero. They can say they're going to do half their emissions by 2030. But how are they going to do that if their actions are pointing to something else? So we have to call out the contradictions between what they say and what they do. We have to call that out. We have to shine a spotlight. And we, you know, I just think there's a point now where all citizens must be sharply aware of the dangers of these decisions that are being made by these rich countries. Sharply aware, because when we experience massive droughts on the continent, when we experience massive flooding on the continent, when we are suffering from food insecurity, you know, where does that all come from? That's not a natural phenomenon. This is exactly because of the actions and decisions made by others elsewhere in the world, including, of course, our own leaders. Let's not forget that. Not that there's no culpability on the part of our own leaders, but certainly those emissions are being driven by globally industrialized countries and sectors, and we're feeling the impact of that. And again, those who are well-resourced are going to be able to adapt, are able to put in risk measures. But who's suffering? Those who are suffering from poverty and inequality, do not have access to resources, basic things like healthcare, education, access to energy, etc. So this is the real problem. The system is set up in a way that will always benefit elites. The poor suffer, the majority in the global south, you know, suffer, and it goes on. So when do we wake up? When do we rise up?
Yeah. And as you're talking about natural disasters, I remember I read something and the scientist was basically saying that there's no such thing as a natural disaster. Most of these things that are called natural disasters are engineered somewhere else in the world. And then going back to, on Africa being the worst affected and certain places being worse affected by others, the Matai Foundation hosted a conversation. We have same storm, different boats. And I thought that was a perfect analogy where although we're all going to go through climate change, we're not all going to experience it the same. We say that it's everyone's going to experience it, but the sad reality is some people will be able to buy themselves out of it. And then the point that you started with of the G7 committing to basically something that's already done, what it made me think of was, so they're not even reaching for the low-hanging fruit. They're just picking fruits off the floor.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, perfectly said. Look, in the end, let us be clear. These countries do not, in any serious and genuine and meaningful way, have a sense of, you know, I keep on using the word solidarity, but they're not really interested in the well-being of people outside of their countries. And even inside their own countries, you will see the same problem emerge. So when we talk about, well, I'm going to again compare COVID and climate. First phase of COVID in the US, for example, who did we see were the ones that were suffering in the US? Black communities, indigenous people, you know, people on the front lines, workers, etc. Again, that phenomenon of the inequality of the impact is something that is exactly the same in terms of the inequality of the impact, the differentiated impact in climate. And it will happen within borders and across borders. And so we must be clear that, you know, the G7, with all their statements, have not really addressed that fundamental injustice in what they're committing to and will continue to act in the interest, their own interests, their own economic interests. As I said, you know, this vaccine story was a very clear example that they were not willing to come out of the G7 really responding to a request from developing countries, please waiver, do the TRIPS waiver. They weren't willing to do that. And in fact, the UK was one of the G7 that just did not want to do that. So that's seriously, you know, for me, that is a worrying signal. Because what will they do now with climate change? Another global crisis, one that is already being felt. Their solutions are going to be all about, it's our companies. We're going to come with the solutions. We have research and development. We're looking at all these alternatives. And then it's going to be a profit-making exercise. You know, not a, we will act in the interest of the public good in terms of the, you know, the interest of the global common good. We're going to act in the interest of our own economies, our own companies. This is a fundamental problem.
Earlier you had touched on, as we draw the conversation to a close, earlier you had touched on alternative models of investment or economic growth. To end on a high note and an optimistic note, what are these alternative models that we should be looking at, we should be advocating for, and if people have the extra funds to do so, should be investing in?
So, Pato, you know, I mean, just to take it at a kind of high level, and then I'll give you concrete examples. Firstly, I do think we have to move away from this notion that it's economic growth, almost at all costs, right? As I said, the kind of track record of that kind of economic growth has been a very incremental and slow change for addressing fundamental issues of poverty and inequality in Africa, but elsewhere as well, right? So there's, in some cases, there have been really rapid economic growth, but very little movement in terms of addressing fundamental inequality, etc. So what I think is that we really have to go back to looking at models of development in the true sense of the word. And of course, we talk about sustainable development, and everybody understands that concept very differently. And so let's talk through that. And for me, a model of development or sustainable development must fundamentally put at the front and center addressing the needs of those who are living in poverty and also to address inequality. So, you know, when we talk about infrastructure investment, then we need to talk about investment in social infrastructure, not just these big projects. Oh, now we're going to have a big, coal-fired power station, or we're going to have a big Inga Dam, or we're going to have a, you know, we have the opportunity to look at very localized, decentralized options for energy. So the example I gave earlier about leapfrogging through renewable energy, in my view, is a really exciting and potentially democratic technology. It's highly mobile. It is really possible to decentralize renewable energy projects, so you don't have these huge, big, centralized, projects. You can't have a coal-fired power station in every little town or village, but you can have a decentralized renewable energy system in every town and village. You can even have it in your own home, for example. So the potential for that, as I call it, the democratic technology, means that our development models can also include and should, especially in a continent like ours, decentralized models of electricity generation, where ownership can be in the hands of people, communities. It doesn't have to be big foreign companies that come in and, you know, we need their investments to come in. We should be funding local community-owned renewable energy projects. We can even have workers form, you know, cooperatives or whatever they want to call it, even on enterprises that can also do that. So we have this opportunity both through, you know, the kind of new models for electricity generation. We have the opportunities to leapfrog digitally on the continent, and there have been exciting examples of entrepreneurs emerging on our continent on the digital front. You know, so we should be looking at opportunities where we can grow our economies, but develop at the same time, and that the results of this will be felt by ordinary people on the continent, that it doesn't only benefit the elites in our society. And so I do think that we have to challenge this existing paradigm about economic growth and, you know, everything is going to come through the private sector, etc. I think there are new and exciting models across the world where people have looked at different ways of, you know, there's a name for it now, but in any case, innovating ways of financing and investment, their community-led processes of doing that. You know, I just think the scope for so many innovations, as long as we don't keep ourselves constrained within this existing paradigm, there's so much opportunity for different ways of approaching things. And I think what excites me most is when I read all these stories about especially young people on the continent being entrepreneurial, exploring new ideas, exploring, you know, becoming pioneers in certain sectors. It just gives me so much hope. But then we need to ensure that the space is there for these innovative young pioneers leading in the African continent. And so we have to put pressure on the leaders who are still stuck in their old thinking and old ways. And so to make it clear that, you know, our future is determined now by the decisions we make now. And so push them into this alternative thinking and show that it is beneficial. And maybe ways of doing that is to already start highlighting, you know, best practices already happening in many places across the continent. But yeah, I'm very excited about the future. We are being held back by outdated thinking and outdated decision-making, people holding on to a past. But the future is here. And that's what excites me. And I think that especially the young, the, you know, youth are just going for it. And I'm so excited about that potential. Yeah.
Firstly, I love the way you responded to that question, where it's everyone on every level can act. We all need to claim that power that we have to create the change that we are hoping for. And then the other thing that she touched on, ecopreneurship, youth and ecopreneurship, so many amazing things happening there. We're going to do about a 2-3 episode special on that, just talking to ecopreneurs across the continent who are merging, making profits with positive impact for the environment, which we are so frequently told that cannot come together. I'm really looking forward to those episodes.
Really exciting, Pato.
Thank you for taking time to listen to this episode of Sustain 267 podcast. You can find links to the projects and documents mentioned in the podcast in the show notes. Please subscribe wherever you listen to this podcast so you are the first to know when we publish a new conversation with Africans on climate change and sustainability in Botswana and the rest of Africa. If you'd like to support the production of future episodes of Sustain 267 podcast, please become a patron from as little as $3 a month. While we're here, I'd like to also appreciate our new sustainer level patron, Stephen. Stephen, thank you so much. You can't imagine how much it means to see people put their hard-earned money behind the production of Sustain 267 podcast. To us, it reflects that what we do matters and there is a gap for it, and people would like to continue to hear this conversation. Thank you so much to all our patrons who have made all the past and future episodes of the podcast possible. I am the host of Sustain 267 podcast, Bata Gilisitse, and the sound engineer is Male Makgoti. Let's connect and continue the conversation on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter on our handle at Sustain 267. Care.
Sustain 267.